Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is a name that I bet is going to be familiar to a lot of our listeners. It is Justice David Gunn from the First Court of Appeals. Justice Gunn, thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure, guys.
Well, just kind of to get us started, maybe give us a little bit of your background, how you got into the law, and kind of how your career has progressed.
I got into the law by accident. It was not planned. I wanted to be an engineer, but my father was a patent lawyer and had made the same change of direction, starting in engineering and finding it not congenial path that he wanted ultimately. I had something similar when I was in graduate school in engineering and found the laboratory too isolated, and I wanted more social interaction with people. I was looking out the window one day, and all of my lab mates were working on their molecules, and my molecule was just as cool as theirs, but I was looking out the window at the girls playing frisbee out on the lawn at college, and I thought, oh, that looks awfully attractive. I'd rather be out there playing frisbee today with the undergraduates. And I began to think, maybe the life of the lab is not where I want to be. But I didn't know where I wanted. And my father said, look, I'm not pushing law, but you could try it. I tried it. It worked for me. And so that's what I did. I thought about patent law, decided that was not the way to go, but stumbled into a clerkship at the 14th court. And that turned out to be just perfect because I got exposure to all sorts of cases and ended up staying on a total of 3 years. And by the end of the 3 years, I had seen most of the mistakes that lawyers make, most of reasons that judges come up with for deciding cases. And, you know, I thought, okay, this is a good time to get off the government train and go into private practice. So that's kind of how I ended up. Well, also I got married at that time, and getting a little bit of a salary increase was imperative. They were paying us $35,000 a year when I left.
Wow.
And, you know, that was not going to be enough, even with my wife's salary added together. We're not going to be able to do very well that way. So it was time to go into private practice, and I've done appeals ever since.
So did you go straight from law school to the court?
Yes. And again, by accident, I knew someone who was an appellate judge, and he said, what are you doing after law school? I said, I don't know. Go back. And we didn't have the internet. You couldn't look around and research firms the way you can. There was Martindale Hubbell, the big hardback for, you know, the sizable firms, but mainly it was just a dartboard, you know, a bulletin board at the placement office with little index cards. 5-person firm in El Paso is looking for someone in the top half of the class, or 10-person firm in Beaumont wants, you know, a trial lawyer. That was all the information you had about law firms in the mid to late 1980s. So I was grateful for any opportunity when this appellate judge says, come work for me for a year and you'll get a little bit more time to look around. And I liked it so much, I stayed for 3 years and discovered it was not court cases or contract cases or criminal cases that I liked. It was just appeals. That's been my life.
When you got started coming out of the court, was there sort of an appellate specialty that had formed, or was it still sort of in its infancy?
It had formed, but as you say, Jody, is only in its infancy. In the late 1980s, the Fulbright and Jaworski firm had a very good appellate group. They produced a number of amazingly talented lawyers over the years. Started with Rusty McMains, then Roger Townsend, Jennifer Hogan, Sarah Duncan, Scott Rothenberg. I mean, the list just went on. And Bill Boyce. I mean, Ben Taylor, just a real murderer's row of excellent lawyers. And a few other firms were starting to get into it, but nothing like what Fulbright had. And there was certainly no proliferation of boutiques like you see now. Mm-hmm. Whereas now you might see a former Supreme Court judge or a couple of former Court of Appeals judges forming their own shop. That was not a thing. Most of the practitioners were familiar with the world where a trial lawyer tried the case and then appealed it. it was uncommon to see full-time appellate lawyers, but that was starting. And I don't remember exactly when the board certification exam began for civil appellate. I think it was in around 87, 88. So there were a few names that you'd see around the state. You'd see Mike Hatchell or Dorsanio and so on, Royal Brenn up in Dallas, but not a lot. And about that time, our mutual friend David Keltner left the Fort Worth court and went to Haynes and Boone and started up an appellate section. It was just getting going. And it took all through the 90s, really, for that fire to spread. Now, of course, it's part of the practice. But back then, it was very much embryonic. And I didn't have any idea what was out there. But I had an offer, grand old man of appellate practice down here in Houston, a fellow named Jim Kronzer. He had two associates, and one of them resigned, and he was looking for a second one. The one who was remaining called me because we had overlapped at the court briefly. She said, "Hey, I heard you got married. I thought you might be looking for a job." I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am." So she said, "Well, let's go talk about it. We've got one. I'll tell you what it is." I didn't know who he was. She said, "Well, you know, the office is just around the corner. Just come by and say hello for 1 minute." I said, "Okay, fine." Said hello for 1 minute and left. What I didn't know at the time was he had been longtime law partners and best friends in law school with the chief justice at my court. So he picked up the phone and he says, "Chief, tell me about this young man, David Gunn." Says to him, "I will not tell you about him. Keep your fat hands off our good employees." Kronzer told me the story years later and he said, "Thank you. That's all I needed to know." He called me and made me a job offer, like right on the spot, partly to hire me, but mostly just to tweak his old best friend. And so here we are. I took it. Was off to the races.
Sure, sound like the shortest job interview process ever.
Yeah, it's one of those. It was all about the references. And it just, I happened to be working for his old longtime law partner. You know, they formed that firm in the 50s. It was Hill, Brown, John Hill, Curtis Brown, and Kronzer. And it lives on today with the name Abraham Watkins. But it's perhaps the longest-lived plaintiff's firm in the history of the state. And, you know, just they do wonderful work. John Hill was one of the first lawyers, I think, to get a $1 million verdict in a personal injury case. Great trial lawyer. Went on to become attorney general. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Curtis went on to the 14th Court, which is where he spent several decades.
Okay.
Illustrious group of folks.
I never came across, probably 7 or 8 years after you in terms of when I came into practice, but I did have the pleasure of practicing at Fulbright with some of those notorious names that you mentioned, including Ben Taylor. And Ben, I remember back going on, gosh, probably 27 years ago, Ben threw out this name, Jim Kronzer. And I was like, "Who?" Because I didn't know anybody in Houston. But over time, that name became known to me just working with Ben, because I know Ben had a lot of respect for him. And of course, Ben's dad taught at South Texas College of Law, and that was from Houston, even though he was by then practicing in Dallas. So that's when I think back to like the original, the OG appellate lawyers in the state of Texas. That name comes to me just because of the people that I know and respect who revered him so much.
He was just remarkable. As I say, he was sort of the pivotal figure in this part of the state for becoming a full-time appellate practitioner. You know, in Texas, we have a history of stubbornness and willing to go to court, a willingness to, you know, to litigate. And people will go to trial. And we, you know, produce some magnificent trial lawyers. But over time, it became clear there was a place for appellate lawyers. Mm-hmm. The procedure and just a second set of eyes on your record. I got the elements covered. Everybody who speaks Texas appellate law knows how big a deal the jury charge is. And, you know, back then, I mean, it's not like the simple old days. You'd have these 50, 60, 70 paid charges in a car wreck case, because you would submit all the inferential rebuttals, last clear chance, and, you know, everything. Just, did he not do this? And was this guy not the sole cause? And it was just a harrowing experience. So you needed somebody to be thinking about the charge. And that's what Bronzer was very, very good at. I mean, he was very good in the appellate level as well as an advocate, but he was at his best in front of a single district judge trying to be persuasive. And you had Royal Brand up in Dallas, who practiced at Strasburger for years and years and years, pioneered things up there. So our friends like Michael Young and so on, now you know Nina Cortell, some of the modern practitioners, Dallas has had excellent appellate lawyers. It's just part of the way the Texas system evolved. And Kronzer really was one of a kind. I caught him at the right time. I was there till the end, the last 5 years of his life.
I don't want to gloss over. I mean, you've had a legendary career in private practice because you've done so many things and we could easily fill an episode, but I kind of want to talk more about your time on the bench and the things that you've learned. I guess, what made you decide you wanted to be on the bench?
Partially the season in my life. It was a good time. My kids are out of school. Mortgage is paid for. But also, we had that expansion, Jody, where Texas said, we're going to add some new structure to our court system, add the business courts, add the 15th. And those steps were a little bit controversial. And I thought, this is a good time in my life. I'll put my name in the hat. I don't know, you know, what kind of person the governor's looking for, but I want to at least volunteer. If you need the help, here's my background. And they did kind of a what baseball managers call a double switch. And so I had applied for the 15th court and they called me up. I had an interview. By the time the dust settled, what they did is they said, we're going to move a judge from the first court, April Ferris, very fine judge, to the 15th, and we're going to put you into her spot, which has been great. I don't need to commute to Austin. I don't need an apartment up there. And I'm in a building with 21 judges. We've got 9 on my court. We've got 9 across the hall, the 14th. We have 2 business judges, the business court judges down here. And we have, Judge Ferris has a chambers here with 15. So I can walk down the hall and drop in on plenty of judges every day. And I do. I go visit with them. It is just a marvelous place to learn the rope. I'm a rookie as a judge, trying to learn, how do you handle this? I've never seen, what is this case? If it's criminal particularly, that's not my background. You know, if there's a particular hallucinogenic drug that I've never heard of, I've got some colleagues. And let me tell you, they've heard of it. Or evidence about ballistics. I mean, all of that, I can get help from other judges in the building. So it's just a bird's nest on the ground for me.
That's fantastic. And a great building to boot on top of that, because you're in the 1910 courthouse in Houston that's just, after the renovation they did, gorgeous. Probably much nicer updated digs than the ones you were in South Texas back in the late 80s.
Yes. The one advantage we had in the South Tech building was we were all on the same floor. So everyone at my court, which was the 14th, we're all on the same floor. There was no such thing as remote work back in the days when there were 2 Germanys. I mean, it was a different world. And you could walk around to other offices and talk to judges. The way we are structured now is we're stacked vertically like an ant farm. Everybody on the north side of the building, that's the first court, and we're all stacked on multiple floors. Same on the south side, that's the 14th. But it is a great building. This was the 1910 courthouse where the cases were tried in 1910 in Harris County. And marvelous history. Too much to go into here, but really cool to think about the cases that took place here way back in the day. There was even a law school that operated here.
Oh, really?
Between the wars. From 1919 until 1945, there was a school called the Houston Law School. And they would have their lectures after court in the courtrooms. A law school without a campus in the conventional sense, it's not associated with UT, Mary's, or Baylor. It was just a place you could go essentially to night school, very much the way South Texas started down the street at the YMCA. And one of the driving figures on the faculty was a practicing lawyer named Ewing Werlein Sr. His son, Ewing Werlein Jr., is a federal judge here in the Southern District, but practicing lawyer Ewing Werlein Sr. was one of the lecturers and eventually became civil district judge in the mid-50s. Then when the Galveston Court of Appeals, the Galveston Court of Civil Appeals, moved to Houston, one of the three members of the appellate court said, I'm not moving to Houston. I quit. So Judge Werlein got appointed to the Houston, now the Houston First Court of Appeals. And he served here from 1957 to 67. Anyway, it's a very storied building with lots of ghosts that haunt the place.
I can imagine.
And two beautiful courtrooms. And I always like to talk up the attorney lounge that's shared between the courtrooms. It's a great facility. Just really, I don't think anybody rivals that, any appellate court I've been in.
It is a magnificent place. I grew up when the civil trial courts were here, and it's hard for me to forget hearing the voices of those judges and those lawyers like Joe Jamail and John O'Quinn and booming down the halls. But, you know, every growing community, you guys have lived through it. You've seen courthouses have to migrate down the street, you know, have a renovation and so on. And it's a growing society, it's a successful economy. We are extremely lucky to be in here. I love getting people in here. We don't have nearly enough for my tastes, but I'm working on it.
Kind of on the topic, you've been on the bench a little over a year now after being in private practice for a long time. I guess what surprised you from sitting in that chair?
One of the big surprises is the nature of the docket is so different from what I had at my law firm. Mm-hmm. I practiced at a litigation boutique of about 40 to 50 lawyers. And we were up against pretty high quality counsel, very challenging. And in a way, it's better to have a good lawyer on the other side. It's clearer. You know what the arguments are. You don't have to spend your time on a lot of rabbit trails. That has not been the case here. We've seen a much different cross-section of practitioners, and I don't see many appellate specialists. I won't say I see zero, but it is far and away to get somebody board certified, to get somebody from the recognized appellate boutique. Now, you don't have to be an appellate boutique to be able to do appeals, not at all.
Sure.
But we get a lot of briefing that I find disappointing. And sometimes that's just the nature of the case. And I think this case just shouldn't be here. Really should not have been appealed because there's no hope. Obviously, criminal is a different beast, but just on the civil side, I think I was spoiled. And people on the other side or as co-counsel of your caliber, that's not what I'm seeing. The vast majority, I mean, you just go to our website and click on some of the cases on the case submission link and just pull up the briefs and read them. And you'll think, okay, that's not really as good as it could be. And I'm not here to throw rocks at people. I just got to tell it like it is, though, and say,
sure,
I'm kind of underwhelmed. And there will be arguments that I just look at and think, this never had a chance. This should not have been appealed, or this mandamus just should never have been brought. That has probably been the biggest surprise, is just how much of that there is. I mean, sometimes it's the standard of review, but whatever it is, the appellate lawyer needs to take that into account up front. Do I really think I have something here? I mean, we all know, don't go hunting with a shotgun, right? Hunt with a rifle. You're the appellant. Right, if you're the appellant, issue selection is the number one task. Winnow it down to smaller number of stronger issues and go with that. That to me is still a plaguing problem. And with the ability to bring mandamus now, right, there's almost no time when you tell the client mandamus is impossible, right? When I started practice, mandamus was very difficult, very rare. You had to file a motion for leave. And there were certain things that the courts would say categorically, that is not subject to mandamus. We don't have those categories now. We now have this balancing that, well, yeah, your summary judgment motion was denied. And normally we wouldn't get into it, but hey, maybe, you know, and you can make your case. It's just a different world. And it's really important for appellate lawyers to think, do I need to take this appeal? Does it need to be this broad? Narrower is usually better.
Surety bonds for court-related matters are a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. CSBA has over 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA is able to provide first-class service with their deep understanding of the appellate process and the various timeframes involved in getting a bond in place.
Are you finding those same observations to hold true in cases that the court is holding argument? Quality of the oral argument as opposed to what you might have expected, certainly in your own cases, I would imagine, but just on from a broader perspective?
The quality of the arguments themselves is not bad. We don't have the really awkward exchanges where it's just hopeless, or, you know, when you go to New Orleans and you might see a case argued and the poor lawyer just gets beat up and doesn't even know how to advocate. I'd like to have more arguments. And I think many of the cases are being screened and decided on the briefs when maybe they shouldn't. But the conversation is good. And, you know, I have to tell my staff, because I've encountered some pushback internally about, we don't need argument on that case. And I've had to say, I believe you. I know you think you don't need it. And maybe you don't. But there's more to the system than just you and just me. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you who needs it is the clients. The public needs it. The clients come up here thinking, so often the appellant comes up here thinking the trial judge was either stupid or bribed, corrupt. Even when that's not true, the vast majority of time, neither of those is true, but the clients genuinely think that. You know, I don't know about your counties, but where I am, it's not as easy to get a hearing in a civil case as it used to be. It's very difficult. So the clients may come up here having lost and having never gotten a hearing with that judge. You know, it's just decided on the papers. Those clients really can benefit from an oral argument. They will come in here, and we've all seen it. You go, you argue your case, the court asks even-handed questions of both sides, and the client goes out of there saying, you know, they get it. Those judges are trying. They understand the case. And you tell them, I don't know if we're going to win or not, but they get the issue. Those clients will accept a defeat because they've had a day in court. I've seen it so many times. If the client feels like they were heard by a fair tribunal, they're much less concerned about the outcome. They feel like they had the process. So that's a service we can supply. But I've had to make that point internally to say, I've had a lot of clients and y'all have not. We really need to do this for the benefit of the clients, as well as for the benefit of the public. The public deserves to see some of the sausages made. And so it's healthy for citizens to be able to walk in, watch an argument, see what the court's doing. All the arguments are recorded now, right? They're on YouTube.
Right.
And that is a great service, not just for lawyers, but for the public.
How does your court decide when cases get argued?
As a practical matter, it's the author, whoever drew it. It's a random distribution of cases, like cards being dealt at the poker table. The author makes that decision. There is technically the right of a majority to override the author, but that doesn't really happen. Everybody's got their hands full. And so if I draw the case, I'm the one who decides, you know, sometimes we'll set an argument because we don't have a clear picture of what's going on. It's confusing. This is a mess. We need to get to the bottom of this. Sometimes we set it because it's not unclear, but it's close, right? You know, not exactly sure what this document means or what this statute means. Let's get people in and have a conversation about it. But yeah, that's up to the author. Now, the 14th Court, they operate by panels rather than sort of the man-to-man defense that we have individualized, but it's more of a zone over there. And the panel will vote. They'll have a majority vote. Do we argue it? Yes or no? There's no perfect system. I assume it's the same way in the second and third court. I don't know. What do you guys know about that?
I think in the third, I think it's more like your court where it's one judge that makes the decision, and it's the same system where whoever's assigned it, when it comes in, that's the judge that gets to make the call on the argument.
I don't know what they're doing in the second court now. I'm not sure what their system is.
You know, the Fifth Circuit, right, has the completely different system, right? Screened up front, goes to the screening panel, and they decide, are we going to write this? Or are we going to kick it into the queue? And any one judge can kick it out of that screening pipeline, just put it in the queue for argument. You know, it's not quite like that here. This puts a lot of responsibility on the author. And so, you know, I'll talk to my folks. And I mean, I will pay attention to things in the brief that say, hey, we want this young lawyer to get board certified. That matters to me. But it's not really a science. We have a certain number of slots to fill up. You know, a few years ago, my court had a total of about 20 oral arguments in an entire fiscal year.
Really?
Yeah, it was not good. And my first year here, we upped that number to 50. If I'd had my way, it would have been 100. If you extrapolated from the number that I caused to go to argument, it would have been 100. And that's what I'd really like. And the 14th court has really driven up the number of arguments. They are arguing stuff there all the time. And I'm afraid they're going to leave us in the dust. I really want to get our numbers up. I just think argument has so much value. And heck, it's good for the court. It can often shorten the amount of time you have to spend on an opinion. If you actually talk about it, you say, oh, wait, I don't need to go into that part of the analysis at all. Now that I see what's going on, never mind all that hard stuff I might have spent 4 days on. I just think argument, if I had my way, I'd have almost every case argued. It might be a short argument. They don't all need full time.
Sure.
But I really like argument, trying to get the numbers up as high as I can.
Do you have a hard time, having been an advocate for so long, you know, not wanting to do people's job for them a little bit, especially if you feel like some of the briefing is not as thorough or quality as it should be? I feel like I would have a tough time with that.
There's so much to do. That is not too bad. It is much less stressful to be the umpire. You know, a big argument I would spend 2 or 3 weeks getting ready for in advance. The last few years, I mean, if it's record intensive, oh my goodness. And I would do, you know, practice arguments. I'd get a stopwatch and work on how far can I get before I have to shift to the next issue and so on. Life now is nothing like that. I mean, nothing like that. It's so different. It's not stressful at all. We'll meet. My panel typically meets in the afternoon for argument, but we'll meet in the morning and we'll chew over the case as a panel with the staff lawyer who's working on it. If I drew it, I will have been working with that staff lawyer on the write-up, essentially the draft opinion, well in advance, probably for weeks. And we'll have a lot of energy put in. But walking into the argument's not stressful at all. It's very straightforward. We are now going over the time limits a lot. So I just tell people, when you come down here, be prepared to your 20 minutes aside argument could easily double or triple. But you may not want to drink all of that big gulp right before you walk in. So it can go. And if we go long on the appellant, we'll add that time to the appellee, whether they want it or not. They're going to get extra time. And, you know, it can easily go beyond an hour for a case, which is not a failure. It's a success. If you're covering substance, it's great. And we've got some very active questioners here now. It's really quite a lot of fun. And I just love argument. I'd like to have more. I don't necessarily want longer briefing, but I do want longer arguments.
I love that take. I acknowledge longer briefing would not necessarily be better. But those kinds of numbers, when you mentioned that the 20 arguments in a whole, you know, 1 year period of time, that's so few arguments for a court with a docket of the First Court of Appeals.
Absolutely. We get 1,000, 1,200 cases in a year. Now, you know, half of those are going to just fizzle out, settle, untimely notice of appeal, whatever it was. They'll be dismissed and, you know, not really resolved on the merits. But you're still going to have a good 500 that are going to need opinions. And so let's get argument. I mean, 50 is a start. I'd like to have more like 100 of those being argued. And they don't all need argument, but a lot of them do. And I just think it's better for the system. That's a long-term work in progress, trying to get that consciousness. I think it's happening. I can't speak to what's happening statewide, but in this building with the two courts we've got, it's definitely on the uptick. People are getting a lot more argument.
I'm hoping that your fellow intermediate appellate court judges hear this and think, Justice Gunn makes a really good point. All the reasons why we need to have more arguments.
I mean, look, there are extroverts, right? There are introverts. There are people who don't need argument. Take Jerry Smith on the Fifth Circuit, for example. He's not an oral argument person. I mean, he participates, but he is perfectly capable working up the case based on the briefs. That's not how my mind works. I actually prefer the give and take, the conversation, the free-form discussion like we're having right here. It can take any direction, and we cover what we need to cover, and when we're done, we stop. That, for me, has so much value. I think partly it is for the clients. I've had so many clients who lost the case but felt like, I was heard and justice was done. Because I got to see three judges and they got to ask hard questions of the other side. That just has a ton of value.
It does. Well, it's also good for the lawyers because if you're only doing 20 arguments a year, that's maybe 20 people, probably not even 20 people that get the chance to argue. And in a city like Houston, that's kind of shockingly low.
That's a good point. You know, every generation needs experience at the courthouse. You know, we don't have one day workers' comp trials that took place in the 1960s. One of my friends long ago, Don Weitinger, got out in the early 1960s. He told me he came down here, started his first day at work at Abraham Watkins. And the secretary said, okay, here is your file. You're going to trial this afternoon at 1:30 in Judge so-and-so's court. It's a workers' comp case. You know, plaintiff lost his thumb, whatever it is. And he's like, I don't know anything about this case. Literally just his first day on the job. And she said, your opposing counsel is old so-and-so. He's a great guy. Go find him down at the courthouse in the so-and-so room. He'll tell you what the case is about. It's going to probably be two witnesses. You'll put on your plaintiff. He'll put on whoever it is. And that's it. And that's how we did it. So those guys, think about how many verdicts they got. They were able to try literally hundreds of cases to verdict. And later in life, parlay those skills into the skills to win a big, you know, billion-dollar antitrust case or a patent case up in East Texas. You know, my former partner, David Beck, started out in the 1960s trying very simple cases. The big firms had an insurance defense doc. They did the workers' comp and so on. Well, those skills do translate. And it's the same with appeals. You get somebody who's had a bunch of oral arguments, even in simple cases, those skills carry over to the monster cases that we all aspire to, you know, to handle as practitioners. It's just good for the profession to get young lawyers some time in the crossfire.
How has the kind of political side of things been? Because, you know, that's very different from the private practice side.
It is very different. I was never especially political. I spent 7 years on a little city council in my West Side municipality, nonpartisan elections, nobody raised money. And so I had really no experience with the big league political process. And that's the system we have. People looked at changing it and with no luck, and there's no reason to think it's going to change. I'm having to learn that. It helps to be around other people who've been through it or to talk to folks who've been through it. We all have our friends that were once in the system, whether it's David Keltner or some other former judge who can say, look, this is kind of how it goes. You know, Scott Brister was a very close friend of mine, and we practiced together on cases or against each other on cases for a number of years before he went back into the system on the 15th. And people like that are a great resource. So I've been able to learn, but I was very surprised some of the regulations. Some of the rules. When I got here, somebody told me, don't ever post a review on TripAdvisor. I said, what? If I go to a good or a bad hotel or read a good book? No. Don't do that. Judges are not supposed to lend the prestige of their office to some private interest. And that just, you're asking for trouble if you post a product endorsement. I thought, okay, I see it now that you explain it. Well, anyway, that's just one small example. There have been a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. I see. Yeah, I get it. The further you get from my desk, the more different it is. So like where you sit now and where I sit now, we're debating the meaning of a statute, interpretation of a contract. That work here is identical to what lawyers do. But the further you get away from that, the more different it is. So if I get invited to a function, I got to think about, okay, should I do this? What are the optics? What are the ethical rules? You've got to raise money. How does that work? Well, I've never had to do that before. I mean, I drummed up business, you know, trying to find clients, but that's not what's going on. Now I have the work, but I have to raise money for a campaign. Well, what are the rules? What are the reporting requirements? All of that is brand new. And I'm getting there, but that is completely new. It's part of our system. Other people have done it. I can do it. But it's required some education.
I keep smiling because of the way that you describe Justice Brister's reentry into being a judge. going back into the system like he was a recidivist or something. I was like, well, I suppose you could look at it that way.
Yeah. You know, he was such a wonderful lawyer to have as co-counsel or opposing appeals. It was just marvelous. He was utterly undisciplined. You could never pin him down and say, hey, here's the plan. I had one where we split the oral argument. And I said, okay, we're going to argue this. We're not going to stay away from this one issue. Okay, I got it. And then what did he do? He got up there and he started arguing. And I just thought, oh my. Because he's so creative. He's so smart. And he'd come up with an idea and say, you know, Judge, something just occurred to me. And he just put it out there. It was his greatest strength. And so he's a real asset to the system to be able to bring that experience to it. But much as I love him, he was a great co-counsel to have, but very challenging to corral.
How does the workflow work on the court side? You know, you don't have the sort of deadlines in the sense that you've got a brief due on this date, but how does it work on your side of things?
Yeah, you're right. You don't have a hard deadline in most of the cases. There are a couple exceptions. The parental rights termination cases do have a hard deadline. You've got your 180 days. You got to get that thing done from the notice of appeal. And that is problematic if the court reporter needs extra time, because that 6-month period is shrinking every day. And then the appellant says, well, I'm busy. I need an extension. And we're also accustomed to extensions in the appellate world, but you can't give unlimited extensions in the parental rights termination cases because the opinion's got to get out. So that has been a challenge. The bigger deadline, Jody, is the 2-year deadline from the notice of appeal. OCA keeps track and is like, are we keeping things moving so that cases are out within 2 years of the notice of appeal? That's kind of the big driver. And so, you know, you can devote resources to this one case if it's harder, or say, no, I got to get this one out because the 2-year deadline's coming. That's really what I deal with the most. And, you know, it's not a perfect metric because measuring from the notice of appeal, like I say, what if the court reporter takes a few months? Mm. What if the parties are okay with extensions because they're not in a hurry? Well, doesn't matter. The 2-year deadline's still out there. And so that's a bit of a constraint that has pinched our ability to get some cases to oral arguments. Like, no, we need to get this thing out. I would like to come up with a fast track, not a rocket docket, but a modified fast track for a number of cases. You know, if we could figure out how do we identify the case, let's say you guys are opposing counsel, and I'd love to have a status conference, get y'all in for 20 minutes and say, let's get this thing out in a year. Let's work backwards. You know, Jody, you're the blue brief, you're the appellant. Can you get it in with no more than one extension? You know, I know the record hasn't hit. Can you start working now? You probably know what you want to appeal. Start working on it now. And Todd, you know, you'll get an extension because you don't know what he's going to argue, but don't ask for two. Let's get this thing briefed. If you guys will get this thing briefed, you know, by 3 to 4 months from now, I'll get you a submission date, say in month 9, and hopefully a decision month 12. Something like that. I think that's workable. I mean, it's a team sport up here. I would need some buy-in from some of my colleagues, but that's what I'd really like, sort of the equivalent of a docket control order in a trial court, to say, let's have a plan. And I don't know how to make that happen. I would really like to. And I think I have more ability on this court because we're not panel driven. We're individually driven. I'm looking for the right case to try that and see, can we get this through here? It would take cooperation. People would have to want to do it. But why not? Then we get it out in a year instead of 2 years, even if it's a big case.
That sounds like a pilot program.
Yeah.
Maybe the appellate section could weigh in on that, Jody. And, you know, it could be something that try it out at your court, Judge, and maybe it could get some wider implementation. Because, you know, one of the things that talking about clients and their expectations is it's really difficult to, as you well recall, advise clients on what to expect as far as time, short of the 2-year measurement that you mentioned. So That could be really valuable, frankly, in terms of being able to gauge timing much better.
Yeah. You know, maybe if we modified the docketing statement so that people could say, yes, put us on, you know, sort of a modified fast track, not anything outrageous, but so they know up front, I should not expect two extensions. And so often the appellant can have a running start, right? You're just waiting on the court reporter to get those exhibits in that last volume of the report's record, but you've got everything, right? You really complain about the summary judgment. You know, you've got daily copy for the things you need. The appellant can frequently get a running start. Yeah, we need to find a way that we can beat up some of these cases because I just think they're just lingering too long. And I never feel like I'm drowning, but I feel like I'm up to my waist in molasses. I can move a step in any direction that I want, but I can't move a long distance very quickly. And so we need to find ways to move things forward.
Appeals can be complicated. With ever-changing rules and procedures, clients need a partner who understands the nuances of every court's demands. Counsel Press has been the trusted appellate services provider for top law firms since 1938. Their team manages everything from complex document preparation to e-filing, ensuring filings are compliant, accurate, and on time. Let Counsel Press simplify the appellate process. Trust their experts to handle every detail. Visit counselpress.com today.
Well, and it's difficult on our side because you submit your last brief and then it just sort of goes into a hole from our perspective because we really don't know. You know, maybe in a month you get a submission notice, maybe it's 3 or 4 or 6 months in some courts and you just don't know what's going on.
Well, that's right. And it's very different between the two Houston courts. You know, on the other side of the hall, the 14th, there it's the panel that runs that. The panel has its own consciousness and it moves things forward and then just says, okay, judges, here's a batch of cases. Over here, it's the card deck, right? It's the poker game. And I get the cards from the dealer. I get every ninth card. And I can get on the computer right now and pull up a notice of appeal that was filed today that lands in my office. And I can look at it. And frequently, just from looking at the notice of appeal, you can figure out, here's what's going on. I can tell, oh, it's denial of an immunity summary judgment motion, or it's a TI appeal, or whatever it is. I can often see a post-trial motion. It's often attached, you know, or the judgment is often attached to the notice of appeal, and I can immediately get an idea. I will occasionally reach down and say, okay, that one, I can see how that story is going to end right now. That temporary injunction order is void. It doesn't have a trial date or whatever the problem. So I'm not going to let that sit for 2 years. We're going to reach down and grab it and move it forward. Or you've got somebody who has a personal issue and you can tell they need a ruling just for their life. They need it fast. So I'll reach in and try to grab it and move it forward. I can't do that in every case. I can only do it in a few, but I'm trying to do that. And I had one where we got an injunction appeal out 6 months after it got here. Boom. Just turned it around and got it done. You know, can't save all the starfish, but you can save one.
Well, you know, you make a good point. It is difficult because there are so many, and I'm using air quotes here, accelerated appeals that aren't really accelerated because when everything's accelerated, nothing is.
That is exactly right. It's like when you're driving on the highway and you get into the HOV lane and it's slower than the regular lanes. And you think, there's something wrong with this picture. I'm being passed by, you know, the Walmart truck next to me. How did this happen? And you're right. When everything's accelerated, nothing is. And we're getting more every few years from the lawmakers. We're getting more appeals. You know, state bail appeals are one. And there's a strong policy reason for it. I don't expect a flood of state bail appeals. But that is an example. I mean, all the stuff in 5104 that it was not there when I started. Very few, right? You could appeal a TI. You could not appeal a special appearance. Well, now you can. I mean, just on and on in media defendants. I'm trying to think of, you know, all the different subparts to 51014 and expert reports. Got plenty of those. The certificate of merit, all that, you know. When you add them all up, parental rights terminations and juvenile certification, we add them all up, you're right. There's not a whole lot of acceleration.
Yeah. You know, you've got parental termination, criminal, you know, everything else that kind of goes on top of the hopper, even above a regular accelerated civil appeal.
That is absolutely right. We're bailing water the best we can, but we need some structural changes. Find ways to get these things in and out of here.
You know, back on the accelerated appeals, it has been my observation generally that those really don't get decided any faster than any other appeal. And it's notable that, you know, the deadlines are shorter. And so maybe the Supreme Court should consider, well, if, as Jody says, if everything's accelerated, nothing is, maybe the rules ought to be changed to make it a little easier on the practitioners, because those shortened deadlines really don't mean anything.
No. You know, if I had a wish to ask for from the genie, it would be the ability that the Fifth Circuit has just to say, affirmed.
Affirmed.
You know, full stop.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to overuse it, but just some of them, you think, okay, there's no there, but I really don't want to explain why, because the reality is this lawyer messed it up. Nothing's preserved. And I'm just going to sow the seeds of dissension if I put that in the opinion. And, you know, there are a lot of times, like with mandamus, we can just say denied.
Right.
With the direct appeals, can't do that. You got to write on the issues. And I would prefer some flexibility to be able to say occasionally, let's not do that. We're just going to say that would be a trade-off, but it would allow us to speed up dispositions a lot. Now, it's not in the cards. I'm not agitating for it. It's just that would be really, really useful, because writing up an opinion in every case, you know, yes, it has public value, but it has public cost as well.
Absolutely.
Well, that's probably a good point for me to come in with our request for a tip or a war story, as we've spent, gosh, more than 45 minutes together talking this afternoon, Judge, and we really appreciate your time. We've certainly enjoyed the conversation. Did you have a moment to think of something, tip or war story-wise, either from your days as a practitioner, which I'm sure there are many of those, and you've maybe given us a little hint on what some of them might be in your view from the bench, but does anything come to mind that would be appropriate for you to share?
Well, one tip would be, in brief writing, if you can streamline the writing, the issues, keep the word count to 10,000, that has a lot of value. Now, there are complicated cases where it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you got a product case with multiple design theories and you got a brief sufficiency on all of it. Okay, that's going to take a while. But if you can hold it to 10,000 words, you will be able to, I think, get more investment from all three judges than if it's a monster brief where two of the judges rely a little more heavily on the author. Say, you know, I'm depending on you to go fly spec that record. If you keep the brief a little bit lighter weight, you're going to get more participation. The incentives are better for the non-authoring judges to really, you've made it easier for them to dive into it. The war story is one that Jim Kronzer told me long ago. We were sitting in court and we saw a young lawyer not know when to tell the judge, thank you, may I be excused, and get out of the courtroom. And, you know, we've all had to learn that. When you won the ruling, stop arguing and just get out. This young fellow had actually gotten the judge to sign an order granting a new trial. And the other side just kept trying to chirp and keep it going. And he took the bait, started debating with them. And the judge began to get interested and said, wait, give me that order back. And he pulled it down.
Oh, no.
And it was particularly brutal because we're not in a position to take an appeal for the fellow, because it was a plaintiff's case. It would have been contingent fee. He would not do a plaintiff's defeat on appeal on a contingent fee. And so it was a painful lesson. And so as we went back to the office, he told me about his first oral argument. It was during wartime. There was still gasoline rationing in World War II. And the way you got gasoline was you would get these coupons. And when you collected enough coupons, you'd go trade them in for some gasoline. So he had his first appeal. It was some kind of probate will contest case. And he had to go to the Waco Court Civil Appeals, drive from Houston. He saved up his gasoline coupons, drove all the way to Waco, showed up in the courtroom, and the panel came out and they said, well, counsel, we have good news and bad news. The bad news is your opponent doesn't have any gasoline coupon, so he can't make it. We'd like to take the case on the briefs. The good news is you've written a good brief, and we think that would be sufficient. And he didn't know the phrase, take the case on the briefs. He said, well, I don't understand, Judge. And they said, you know, decide the case without oral argument. But I've come all this way, really ready to go. And they said, no, it's not necessary. Well, he wasn't getting the hint. And they finally said, look, if you really want to argue, you can, but we don't think you need to. It's like, oh, I really want to argue. Okay, they said with some exasperation, podium is yours. And he began to argue. And as he did, they would say, wait, oh, is that what you're saying? Oh, and the light begins to come on and his case begins to fall apart right in front of his eyes. And by the time it was over, his whole appeal lay in shambles at his feet. And they not only ruled against him, when he took it to the Supreme Court refused the writ outright and adopted the opinion. It's a case called Olds against Traylor. And he said, so let me just say it this way. Oral argument and its value is incomparable. And so I always remembered when you're winning, you don't need to argue any further. Just get out of the courtroom. So that, I don't know if that's what you had in mind, Todd, but that's one I remembered and we need to hand it down.
That's a great one.
Oh, hey, that is a tremendous war story and a very wise, a hard lesson to learn for one thing, but a very wise thing to pass on to the next generation. So thanks for sharing that, Judge. Well, thanks again for spending the time with us. We really enjoyed it. We think this is all going to be really interesting to our audience. So really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, guys. It's really good to see y'all. Keep it up. This is a wonderful, wonderful service you do.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.